coming up on the local news hour this morning. Tom Fisher, Summit County Manager, will be talking about the agenda for tomorrow's county council meeting, also be discussing the rollout of the vaccine here in Summit County. Later on, I'll be talking with architects with the HKS firm, Amir Torsik and Tommy Zakchevsky. We'll be talking about the architectural changes and the sustainability details for the base project there at Park City Mountain Resort. And finally, Cheryl Fox, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, with an update on some open space issues. Stay tuned. With the Summit County Council meeting tomorrow, starting in work session at 1:25 to interview applicants for vacancies on the Mountain Regional Water District, that before they go into a closed session, and then we'll reopen the work session at 3:15. Again, all this being done virtually. On the phone with a preview, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, let's talk a little bit about, you had said that you had some information on Governor Cox's order and the vaccination rollout.
Sure. So, you know, the governor let out pretty strongly at the end of last week, looking at the priorities that health districts had been following, and basically said that this week school district personnel would start to be the priority, and next week the 70-plus age population. And what that means for Summit County, you know, we were already planning on starting to vaccinate the school district personnel this week. That's about 1,200 folks in total between the three districts in the county. And then the next week with the age 70 plus population, that's at least 3,200 people in our county. That's just census population. That doesn't include visitors or second home residents. And, you know, one of the things that we want to get across is that we're only receiving about 200 to 300 vaccine doses per week right now. And so given that flow of vaccine delivery, it's going to take us 3 to 4 weeks to complete the school district personnel itself. And then you add on the age 70 plus population, and it's going to extend that timeline out for those next two priorities quite a bit, unless the vaccine delivery flow starts to increase. Now, we do expect that to happen at the beginning or middle of February, but we just want to get across that even though we're registering people and getting appointments and trying to do that as quickly as possible, it's all hampered by the delivery of vaccines into the county, and we just hope for people's patience in that.
Yeah, so about that registration, I mean, I went ahead and registered, but how do you know where I fit in? I mean, didn't ask me for my age, you didn't ask me for any pre-existing conditions, anything like that.
You know, you're going to be contacted back within that, you know, We're putting together these things as changes are made, you know, we do have a registration specifically for the 70 plus population. We have that on our health department website, so that population can go immediately and register, and we'll get those into the queue. Everybody else, we're just going to have to take it as it comes and see if there are any other changes to the priorities as we move along.
Okay. And I'm going to be talking with Rich Bowler tomorrow. We'll get more specifics then in terms of how it's rolling out for the schools. Let's move back to the agenda. First up, again, at about 3:15, the Weber Basin Water representatives will review the Snyderville Basin Water Compact and the reasons for it. Does the Weber Basin have any major pipeline projects planned here?
You know, it doesn't look like it at this point. You know, I think what we're going to hear from the folks at Weber Basin Water is that we still have surpluses available in the near future within Summit County and within the compact. And therefore, they don't see the need to make that decision about future importation projects. But I think there's also going to be some discussion about opportunity. You know, there is a new administration coming. There could be opportunities for federal help in regards to water projects. So Weber Basin Water will always be looking at those opportunities, and if it's something that applies to our compact, they will be pulling together the members. And it's very clear within the agreement and within this presentation that they are the ones that make the final decision on that. But that's the picture we're looking at right now.
And I just interviewed Jordan Clayton from the NRCS Snow Survey about our dire snowpack situation. Any idea whether the Weber Basin reps will be talking about this?
Well, you know, we heard Dave Uhr, who is the Summit County member on the board, talk about that last year. I am quite certain he is going to continue talking about that as he meets with the council this year. It is getting to be a dire situation. We're seeing several drought years in a row, a couple of good years followed by a couple of bad years, and that gets concerning.
Yeah. Dave, you still will remain as the representative on the Weber Basin Board?
As far as I'm understanding, that's correct.
All right. A report on the legislature, of course, that's starting January 19th. The report noted that the Majority Whip Senator Daniel Hemmert, who was supportive of Summit County, now moving on to the GOED under Governor Cox. The report in the packet seems to suggest that the new whip may be not as good to work with.
Well, I mean, I think it's all about, at this point, relationships. And, you know, Summit County is sometimes challenged in that in a lot of different manners, whether that has to do with political affiliations or the amount of revenue that we produce. Some of the policies that are in place between Summit County or some of its municipalities in regards to land use, because land use is a large focus of the legislature, and so we're always dealing with that and working around those relationships and making sure that we can use both the Utah Association of Counties or use our relationship or our role within that, and then our relationships with other counties to advance things that are in the interest of Summit County.
So do you expect any fallout? I mean, speaking of land use, any fallout from the hideout controversy? And is that going to be good or bad for Summit County?
I think the hideout controversy is an example in a long line of things that are that work sometimes counter to Summit County's desires in land use. Both the creation of Hideout and then the latest iteration of short-term legislation are examples. And we will do our best to keep active in those issues so that we can be on top of it if something happens.
The county wants to get legislation so that the community resort tax can be spent by counties. You going to have any luck with that?
Well, we don't know. I mean, that traditionally is something that the cities within the state have been very protective of. We've always thought that it's somewhat unfair to unincorporated residents that feel the same impacts, that we can't figure out a way within, you know, those very discrete resort areas and areas that support that from a retail or commercial perspective. That we couldn't take advantage of the same theory. So we're going to continue to work on that very closely with the Utah Association of Counties and see if we can make any headway.
All right. Any plans to try and get funding for transit or road improvements?
Well, always. And we've already seen within the governor's proposed budget some of the initiatives that we think the legislature is going to be working on, that infrastructure is going to be a big deal. And we know that the state is interested in transit. They're interested in transit in relation to Summit County and I-80. And then also some of our larger transportation problems as they relate to the state and federal highways, we're going to be pursuing those as well.
All right. Council will also get an update on the CARES Act funding. The county received nearly $6 million in three tranches and had to spend it by the end of 2020. Did it all get spent, and did we make good use of it?
I think we made good use of it. It was a Herculean effort, and you'll notice in the report that Jenny Young mentions quite a few people within the county that worked on that. If you look at it, we granted out to our community or figured out ways to help our community members, both business and individuals, with over a third of that money. That was one of the areas where we were successful in moving that money into the community, and so that it could roll around in the community and provide that second and third spend benefit. We found ways to help out a lot of different groups survive through this economic downturn caused by the pandemic, and then to shore up the actual response by the county and very significantly our school districts. Their school districts were kind of left out of the first distribution of money, and so we felt it was necessary to help out where we could.
Yeah. Also, the county worked with UDOT on a Kimball area plan over the past year. What did this result in?
Well, I mean, it's not done yet. We're kind of in one of the stages of that plan where alternatives have been developed, most notably for Summit County and the unincorporated area around the Kimball Junction interchange, and the two signals on SR 224 in the Kimball Junction area, the two signalized intersections. I think it's very interesting to look at all those alternatives. They're kind of at the stage where those alternatives are being presented with their advantages and disadvantages, and hoping to get feedback from a lot of different areas on how we feel about those, how we think they're being represented within the report, and to ask questions about those. The whole purpose of this process is to get to alternatives that then can be pursued to the next step, which, you know, gets them into the queue to eventually be implemented. And we all are expecting that improvements come to that area sometime in the future. So the more that we can push this and be involved in it and make sure that local desires are known there, the better.
Again, it looks like we've got four alternatives. I mean, things that include new interchanges, overpasses, HOV lanes. Are you asking council members to indicate what plan they like?
I think we're expecting council members to provide feedback. If the council can come to consensus on feedback that we want to provide into the process, we'll do that. But certainly individual council members are also okay to do that. I think we're just trying to bring some public exposure to the process, because sometimes UDOT's processes kind of hover above county and city work in some ways and don't get the attention they need. And, you know, it's very timely, just happen to have it on the same agenda that we're taking public comment on the Dakota Pacific project, which is directly impacted by what will happen with that area in the future with its transportation system.
Yeah, so how does the county get a plan on UDOT's to-do list in order to get the funding? And is that like 20 years away?
I don't think it's 20 years away. I mean, Derek Radke would joke, in fact, recently just did, that it took him 14 years to get the Jeremy Ranch interchange completed from, you know, concept start with UDOT. I don't think it's going to take that long. I think there's a bigger need there. I think we have some reasons and some recent, you know, the area is kind of developed out except for the Dakota Pacific property, and it needs those improvements. And it's really affecting how our area is seen and viewed from a tourism perspective, that we have major congestion there on a regular basis. So I think UDOT's interested in that. I think our legislature is interested in that. Certainly local leaders are interested in that. And there's probably both local money and perhaps even some commercial tax generation that can help forward that into UDOT's process and partner with some state and federal resources.
Okay. Let's see, the wrap tax recommendations. Council scheduled a vote on those. Last week, Councilmember Doug Clyde had some reservations about a couple of projects, but do you think the council, as usual, ratify the recommendations that the Citizen Advisory Committee's made?
I believe they will. I mean, it's certainly up to the council on these issues to question those things. And, Peter Tomei, the committee chair, has gone back to Park City and asked some of those questions, and I think Park City is prepared to talk about those. So we may see them tomorrow in that part of the meeting. The committee has made their recommendations, and now it's up to the council, and we'll see what they do.
Also, a public hearing on the Dakota Pacific plan for the Boyer Tech Park property. Is the council prepared to go into the night on this one if you have to?
Well, I mean, we want to hear. I mean, I know the council wants to hear as much as they can from the public. There has been a tremendous amount of public input on this project already, and the council is very aware of that. You know, they get all the transcripts and the minutes from Planning Commission meetings as they prepare for this project, and of course, there's been a lot of written correspondence to the council on this project, but we know there's going to be active public comment tomorrow night, so I believe that we will be having a late meeting.
Yeah, this could be the biggest public hearing the council's had since the pandemic. Is the Zoom technology ready?
I believe we're ready. We have we've been using this technology for a long time. We have it. We have our accounts robust enough to handle that. I'll be making sure of that too before we meet tomorrow.
Yeah, the agenda does say possible adoption. How likely is that?
I would say it's very low.
Okay. Does the planning staff have a recommendation at this point?
I defer to the staff report. I think the main focus tomorrow is going to be public input. And I still think there's a lot of deliberation to happen by the council.
Okay. Hey, I also wanted to ask you off the agenda, there's a group of property owners who have contacted GetGetPart apparently to investigate how Summit County deals with people who discover that they've been paying the taxes of a second property owner, even though they're a primary property owner. Have you guys been contacted at all about that?
We haven't. There are statutory processes around all that, and property owners have responsibility as well as the county, the county assessor's office in those processes. I would say that it's equal to everybody in how we handle that.
Right. And as we know, the county's answer is too bad, no refunds. I mean, would it be the same if the county found out that maybe I had been paying as a primary owner, but really was a second property owner? I mean, would I then have to pay the taxes that weren't collected?
I'd have to defer to the assessor on that, on how she handles that.
Okay. Also wanted to ask you about the status of the Belcher property there that backs up to U.S. 40, the site of the new Children's Justice Center. My understanding is that construction is still ongoing, and I guess I thought that the sale went through. We paid full market price, and because there was just very little remodeling that needed to be done.
Well, it's my understanding that we're moved in and operating out of that building, unless Margaret Olson tells me different. That's the latest that I had heard, so... I'm not sure if there is ongoing punch list related to that construction or not.
All right. Anything else, Tom, you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I do. I have several boards that are open right now. Snyderville Basin Transit District, if people are interested in serving on that board, it closes at tomorrow at 5 p.m. The Board of Health has openings. Basin Rec has Administrative Control Board has openings. Those close on February 3rd. And the Restaurant Tax Advisory Board is looking for a restaurant owner to serve, and that closes on January 27th.
Okay, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The Park City Planning Commission is scheduled to take up the Park City Mountain Resort Base Area parking lot redevelopment at its meeting on January 20th. Since the last meeting, the developer PEG Companies and the architects from the HKS firm have been reworking some of the plan. On the phone with details, I have Tommy Zakchewski, the Director of the Building Engineering Physics, and Amir Rusik, the Senior Project Architect and Principal of HKS Architects. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Amir, let's start with you. What were the marching orders then from PEG for you to go back and redo some of the drawings?
Well, as you know, the Parcel B has received a lot of attention from the very beginning, and it has undergone major programming, massing changes. And in the last November meeting, we heard it very loud and clear from the Planning Commission as well as the community that the pedestrian and mountain view corridor, if you want, on Parcel B was a very critical component of the original master plan and something that both the Planning Commission as well as the community wanted to maintain. So the marching orders were pretty clear, consistent with what we heard from both of these entities, to go back and basically see how we can make it work, and that's what we did.
So is that the only changes that then have been made, were to Parcel B?
In general, yes. Yeah. That was the primary focus. There were some additional changes that is, as a result of that. We created a very large opening on Empire Avenue. We created basically about an 80-foot wide opening to create the pedestrian and view corridor on Empire, which obviously had a domino effect on the current massing program, parking count, residential density. So there were other changes as a result of that.
Right, and that's what I guess, I just to locate it for people, parking, Parcel B is the biggest parcel, and it's really the furthest parcel to the south, what we know as kind of the main parking lot there for Park City Mountain. This is where we're proposing to put, what, the employees, some affordable housing, about 3,500 square feet of retail. What else is there? Day lockers?
That is correct. Parcel B, located on the upper parking lot, as we call it today, if you want, has a very complex program. As you alluded to, it accommodates the parking for the day skiers, the affordable housing component in accordance with the current land management code that has to be provided in the first phase of the project. A small amount of retail facing the resort, and then residential private condominiums as well.
Yeah, so again, to make this 80-foot wide opening, did you take out density or did you have to add it on top or underground?
So what we had to do to make up the lost parking count, we basically had to go deeper into the ground and introduce almost an entire level below grade. And we did lose some density on both affordable as well as the residential condominium building that we're trying to mitigate and accommodate on other parcels, such as Parcel C, that is a lot closer to the mountain and therefore has a little bit more flexibility in terms of its scale and size, if you want.
Yeah, and so those the buildings that are going to be built along Empire there, how tall are those going to be?
Well, Empire has changed quite a bit since the original submission. Again, based on the feedback that we've heard primarily from the community as well as the planning department, Empire now has, for the most part, three-story townhomes that are lining and cascading down Empire from Manaway all the way down to this new pedestrian connection that we just talked about. And they're going to be three stories high. And in that regard, very close or relatable to the existing residential buildings across the street. On the opposite side of the pedestrian connection or 14th Street corridor, as we call it, we have an affordable housing building that varies in size. It basically, at its tallest point, it's six stories, and then it steps down to about four stories at the corner of Shadow Ridge and Empire Avenue.
Yeah, and I guess it's there's some concern, though, again, those houses there along Empire, because they're being built uphill from the houses across the street. And while only three stories, again, they've got the benefit of elevation. So are those homes then going to be shaded, the older homes across the street?
Shaded, depending on the time of the day and the year, possibly, yes. We have initially submitted studies for this, and we're certainly willing and working on providing updated
solar studies, if you want, based on the new design. One of the obvious challenges with this project is we have this density that has been transferred to the existing parking lots on all parcels, right? Mm-hmm. Parcels B, C, D, and E, in return for protecting the behind terrain and the ski area base resort from any future development. So inevitably, there is going to be some density that is a lot higher compared to the adjacent residential neighborhood as a part of that original 98 agreement. But we're doing our best, as you alluded at the beginning, to modulate the massing and really mitigate and minimize the impact on the adjacent neighborhoods.
Yeah. And as you know, there's been a lot of concern from the public about people getting to the base of the resort safely. Explain to me how this 80-foot wide opening does that.
Sure. Well, before we maybe start with the 80-foot opening, it may be worth noting that our current design compared to what we have today, which is basically a parking lot with no sidewalks and people kind of walking on the street and across the parking, we are providing very generous sidewalks that will give everybody opportunity to go around Parcel B to basically two major pedestrian crossings on Lowell to enter the resort. So there will be a major pedestrian crossing more or less aligned with the current location, if you want, on the corner of Shadow Ridge and Lowell. And then there will be another pedestrian crossing lower on the corner of Lowell and Shadow Ridge. And the idea is that we give people coming out of the garage the opportunity to go either to the existing base or upper payday lift, or they can also go down to the lower base resort where we have Eagle and the first end lift. So right now there is an opportunity to walk around Parcel B, which will be a much friendlier experience than what we have today and a lot safer. But in addition to that, we now have created a pedestrian connection that's aligned with 14th Street, very much in the way the original master plan did. But we're providing a much more generous opening. The original master plan called for a 30-foot wide opening or connection view corridor, whereas our current plan right now on Empire is providing an 80-foot wide opening, which will provide a much better view and aperture of the mountain. It will provide a small public space on Empire that will be nicely landscaped and provide seating areas. There will be a grand stair that takes you up across Parcel B. Unlike the original master plan, we're also providing dedicated elevators. In today's world, obviously accessibility is mandated and not optional, so there will be an elevators on both sides of this pedestrian connection. So we're creating a very pleasant public space. And if you choose to go across the side, then around the side, you'll be working through, if you want, a village, a residential village that very much relates to the existing base area.
All right. Tommy, let's turn to you. You've been working on the sustainability aspects of the development. So I guess, what are the biggest sustainability components of the project?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe I first kick off and really say that Park City really has an ambitious but achievable climate goal to be net zero carbon and meet the community's needs of electricity through renewable energy. That's by 2030. And really, as a profession, architecture, engineering, construction, we are accelerating towards making development more sustainable with the lowest carbon footprint possible. And to support Park City's resolutions, the project, what we're targeting is to be more energy efficient, and that's 20% betterment than current code. And that's really to stay ahead of the curve. And we know that we're going to be in the ground and complete in a couple years out. And we know there's going to be code changes, so we're anticipating those changes by making the development more sustainable right now, sort of a future-proof-ready strategy. We're also taking a look at integrating on-site photovoltaics, or PV panels. That's really going to support the annual energy demands of the parking program. And I've got to say, the size of this array system that's going to be spread out throughout the parcels on the rooftops is going to be around a 678-kilowatt array. Now, that's about three-fourths of an acre, and that could equivalently support the energy demands of around 100 homes in the area. So it's a pretty big, substantial photovoltaic array that's going to be providing renewable energy. We're also taking a look at, sort of currently in the feasibility study, of integrating a micro modular anaerobic digester. And what this piece of technology does is it enables the waste that's generated, organic food waste, to be broken down on site and turned into biogas that is a renewable energy source. And the amendment that comes out of it is fertilizer. So we're able to create fertilizers for local gardens, for community members to use that. And the whole purpose of this, it's sort of threefold. Reduce emissions due to waste hauling, create renewable energy, and be regenerative by creating this fertilizer on site.
So where is that proposed to go?
We are looking at positioning the anaerobic digester within the parking program, but making it convenient to help support the restaurants and the community members of the development to bring that organic waste into this digester.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm wondering. I mean, so they would actually physically have to carry it to the digester.
Yes, yeah. So we're trying to work out working on the logistics of how do we get it from point A to point B to really make it effective.
Right, because I mean, you think about some of the. I mean, are we talking about just within the project, or are we talking about bringing that all of the waste from the mountain as well?
No, it won't be able to support all the waste from the mountain. It's really positioned to support the waste at the parcels.
Okay. And when you talk about fertilizer, you know, we all think, well, fertilizer stinks. Will there be any smell to this?
No. So the systems that we're evaluating are really self-contained. There's no odor. The fertilizer is liquid. There's not going to be any off-gassing. And we're just looking at ways of, you know, how do we store it? How do we use it? How do we share it? That's usually the biggest challenges with this type of technology is what do you do with the amount of fertilizer, liquid fertilizer, that you could use, which is really enriched with a lot of good nutrients for any type of plant growth.
So we haven't seen any very specific drawings of the buildings. Should we expect what we're seeing, you know, kind of now that's happening in the architectural world, lots of glass?
I wouldn't imagine so. There's a delicate balance, especially in the climate of Park City, to really balance the amount of glass versus hard surfaces to both account for passive heating, which is a great energy efficiency strategy, but also providing the right amount of insulation to create comfort and to reduce energy demands. And when you balance those two together, putting the glass where it's best positioned to account for those passive measures, you position the project as a more efficient design. So it's a balancing act for positioning glass in the right areas.
Okay. All right. So again, you guys are going to make these presentations then at the January 20th meeting. Anything else you wanted to add about it today?
I just want to say and note that, you know, we're really working closely with Park City to refine our sustainability guidelines. Most of the things that we're presenting are really anticipating the future demands of the community to make it more resilient and livable. We know climate change is real, and we're trying to mitigate those risks and impact to the community and to the world by making this development as sustainable as we can. So we look forward to the challenges and working with the city and community to really make this a beacon or a standard of sustainability in the future.
Okay, and Amir, did you want to add something?
Well, sorry, Leslie, if I was cutting in. I just wanted to, your question about architecture is a great one. It's maybe important to understand what this original master plan is all about. Master plan is really about large ideas, the ideas about making a place, about creating a new identity for the Park City Mountain Resort that really matches its reputation as one of the largest and best ski resorts in North America and in the world for that matter. So at this point, we're really focusing on these large ideas, and architecture that you're seeing is basically, I would think of it as three-dimensional diagrams that we will continue to evolve and develop. To give you an idea, each parcel will take about a year to design. So right now, architecture is really playing a supportive role to the larger idea of the master plan objectives. So what you're seeing now is not necessarily what we'll see at the end of the day. There will be a lot of refinements to it. And I think it's just an important point to make just because of all the attention that's been on architecture since the beginning of the process.
Okay. Well, Amir, Tommy, thanks so much for your time this morning. Well, the identity of the man who died in Friday morning's avalanche has been released. The Summit County Sheriff's Office says the man who died is Kevin Jack Studerman, a 31-year-old from Clinton, Utah. He was snowboarding along with his girlfriend on skis in backcountry terrain outside the boundaries of Park City Mountain Resort on the Canyons Village side in the area known as Dutch Draw. According to the report from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, after riding the 9990 chairlift, the couple exited the ski resort boundaries and made the short hike along the ridgeline to the top of Silver Peak. Studerman started down the line called Conehead. About halfway down, the skier started her descent. After two turns, an avalanche broke at the skier's feet, and while the skier was able to avoid the avalanche, Studerman was caught, carried, and buried. There's no way to know who triggered the slide or whether it was just the combination of both of them on the slope. The Avalanche Center reports that there have been multiple avalanches triggered remotely in the past week, including a slide near No Name Mole along the Park City ridgeline on Sunday. Conditions in the backcountry remain extremely dangerous, and only those with excellent route-finding skills should venture out. Be well prepared with a beacon, shovel, and probe, as well as a buddy. You can find out the latest conditions by going online to utahavalanchecenter.org. Well, for the first open space report of the new year, here's Cheryl Fox, the director of the Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
So you're working with the city of Midway to help save the agricultural property there on the Mountain Spa property.
That's right. We have been working with Midway for about almost a year now to preserve the Mountain Spa property. People will know this as you drive into Midway on River Road, and there's a roundabout there. If you go directly kind of to the west on Bergie Lane, this property is on your left. And if you stay on River Road and go to your a little more towards sort of Midway's Main Street on River Road, this property then is on the right. So it's kind of right at the entry of the town of Midway, and it's across the road from the Kohler Dairy, which Utah Open Lands is working to protect. So this just increases the agricultural open space right there as people come into Midway.
Okay, so tell us, you're working with money from the bond, and that didn't pay for everything there?
It didn't pay for everything. Yeah, we're working with the open space bond money in Midway. We also have an agreement from the Wasatch Open Land Board for some open space money there, too. This is a really interesting project. The town of Midway also has approved or is working to approve a renewal of the old mountain spa that is on the property. So there's a defunct spa. It was, you know, back in the 90s, it was still there. It was actually the first hotspot spa area in Midway. Back in the old days, it was called, I think, Luke's Hot Springs. So there's a group of people who would like to see that restored and some sort of a hot springs resort created there. And the town of Midway is in favor of that because they need the resort activity to keep their resort city sales tax. So we have an agreement with a person who wants to develop the spa there that limits the amount of development that can happen on the spa property, but also does provide this the spa, and it will be publicly accessible as well. So people will be able to go in and enjoy the hot springs once again, we hope. The other thing that's happening here is the agricultural open space that we're working to protect could have been developed up to about 60 homes. And the issue here was that this land was so expensive because it's within the city limits, it's got this resort development opportunity there. The existing zoning was really intense on this property, so it made the property very expensive. So using public money to buy it, there really wasn't enough public money, so we had to be a little bit creative here. So what we're looking for now, basically, are a couple of local heroes, if you will, people who would be willing to come in and buy a large 18 to 20 acre farm estate that would be subject to a conservation easement. So there's building envelopes where they can still build a nice home and a barn and things like that, but they will be protecting most of the open space that you see as you drive into Midway on this property.
Okay. You also have a couple of other projects in Wasatch County?
We do. We have a landowner that has purchased property, a Provo River, that is adjacent to land that they already own and have placed under a conservation easement. And they're expanding their easement by 80 acres, and that will be coming later on this year. And then we have had some other conversations that I hopefully will be able to talk about next month.
Okay. Also, I wanted to ask about your new headquarters. When I talked to Caitlin and Kate last month, they said that you were in your new offices, but then afterwards I heard that you decided not to move in with Mountain Trails and Foundation, so you have your own offices?
Yes, we do. We had been, you know, we were living in Club Med with Mountain Trails Foundation for the last year and a half, at the old medical center there behind the Maverick. And, you know, there's so many synergies between the work that we do to save the land and then Mountain Trails to make it accessible, that we just were hoping to be able to combine our efforts and find a location that would be suitable for both organizations. But in the end, you know, our needs are pretty different. They need a lot of space to house their equipment and things like that, and we need offices because land conservation happens in offices. And so in the end, they bought the Belcher's Barn, or are, I think, working to buy that out by the Home Depot exit out there, mm-hmm. Silver Summit Drive. And we found a location in Prospector. So we are now in Prospector, and we're really happy to be there. It's bright, it's clean, and it's a good opportunity for a good location for our staff. You know, we have a very professional, hardworking staff. Although with the pandemic, we're still, a lot of us are still working from home.
Right. So, I mean, you're just leasing these offices then, as opposed to owning them?
We bought it.
Oh, okay.
We were able, you know, a realtor on my board said, if you can afford the down payment, you're better off buying it. We found that buying this property, the mortgage was less per year than renting would have been. And the places that we were looking at renting were, you know, they weren't offices. They would have been repurposed, you know, other spaces. And so, you know, they were awkward and in one case painted purple and red, and it would have just been a difficult fit for us. And again, like I said, this was the most affordable option.
So are you in that new building there on Prospector?
We are in the Gold Dust building. Mm-hmm. It's where the Lodestar magazine used to be, right across the street from the Silver Mountain Sports Spa and right next door to the Grubstake.
So did you buy the whole building? Because it used to be...
Oh, no. No. We bought it what's called an office condo.
Okay. Yeah, because there were two offices, Park City Lodging, I think, in there, and some law offices.
I think we're actually right next door to that building where Park City Lodging used to be.
Got it. Okay.
But I do want to say a couple of other things. We have a couple of activities happening coming up that I wanted to let people know about. The first is we have started a book club because while we're all still in pandemic mode, it's safe to stay at home and read a book. And our first book will be called, we will be reading together, is called The Soil Will Save Us. And people might have heard of a documentary that's been out on Netflix called Kiss the Ground, which I would encourage people to get a hold of and watch. It's inspiring, and it's, you know, there's so much doom and gloom out there in the world. The Soil Will Save Us, this book, and the documentary are really inspiring. So we hope that people will be interested. If you'd want to get a hold of the book, The Soil Will Save Us, by Kristen Olson. And we will be joining together on Zoom on the last Thursday in February to read that together or talk about it. That's February 25th. And we think that we'll do this a couple more times over the course of the year with some books that we at the Summit Land Conservancy have found really inspiring and enlightening around the work that we're doing for land conservation.
Okay. Anything else?
And then one more thing. We are having a moonshine adventure again in conjunction with Communities That Care and our nature bathing program that we did this summer, which was super popular. You go out into nature, and it's not a super athletic event. It's much more meditative. And so we're going to be doing that under the light of the full moon. That will be on Thursday, January 28th at 7 p.m. We'll be going into Round Valley. People do need to bring appropriate equipment for that, and they also need to sign up on our website, wesaveland.org, because masks are still required, and we can only have 20 people.
Okay. Thanks so much, Cheryl. Talk to you next
Thank
month.
You.
Cheryl Fox is the executive director of Summit Land Conservancy. Well, and I'm sad to report that Carlene Riley has passed away. You may remember Carlene from Uptown Fair there at the top of Main Street, and then went on into the Kimball Arts Center for a while. Of course, her incredible home-cooked meals that she made for nearly two decades. She passed away again yesterday morning. She was at home with her family when she passed. Gosh, her soup and sandwiches will be missed, as well as her big heart. So condolences to her friends and family.